Good morning. On today's programme, the aftermath of the Kahovka dam collapse and thirsty elephants rampage through a North Cameroon city. But first to Sierra Leone, where European election observers in the West African country said there were statistical inconsistencies in the presidential results published by the Electoral Commission, which declared President Julius Maada Bio the winner. Bio was re-elected to a second term with 56% of the vote, narrowly avoiding a runoff against main rival Samora Camara, who had about 41%, according to the official tally. Mr. Camara has rejected the outcome, saying the results were not credible. The election has been tense, with violence breaking out before, during and after the vote. From Sierra Leone, Sunny Hayden reports.
As the results of Sierra Leone's disputed presidential election were read out on Tuesday afternoon, Electoral Commission officials were sitting in front of a banner which bore, among other things, the logo of Irish Aid. Incumbent President Julius Maada Bio of the Sierra Leone People's Party was declared the winner, according to the Electoral Commission announcement. The 59-year-old had received 1.566 million votes, or 56.17%, topping the 55% he constitutionally needed to avoid a runoff. Bio's main contender, Samora Camara, of the opposition All People's Congress, got 41.16%. The atmosphere had been tense across the West African coastal nation, which has a population of roughly 8.4 million people. Citizens were worried about violence, but they were also thinking longer term, hoping whoever came into power could do something to improve their daily lives. Like many other countries in the region, Sierra Leone is experiencing high inflation and depreciation of its currency, leading to increased suffering in what was already one of the world's poorest countries. There were some cheers from Bio's supporters in the conference centre when the presidential results announcement was made, and then it was a dash across town to State House for journalists who wanted to try and catch his swearing in. On the back of a motorbike, I passed crowds of SLPP supporters. They were clad in matching green t-shirts with Bio's face on them, dancing and singing, and playing music and drums. We crossed several checkpoints before armed guards escorted us through a crush of supporters at the State House gates. But all the chaos meant we were already too late. Roughly an hour after the final results were announced, Bio took his oath of office. For his first term, Bio, a former military officer who led a coup in the 1990s, was lauded internationally. His government was praised for its perceived progress on education and women's rights. But citizens and analysts have also been concerned about growing authoritarianism and what they see as an increase in state violence. Last August, protests related to the soaring cost of living resulted in the deaths of at least 28 civilians and 6 police officers. Security forces fired live ammunition, hitting protesters and non-protesters alike. Later, I interviewed several of the bereaved families who spoke of their trauma and distress because the state refused to give them back the bodies of their loved ones for months. I was in the mortuary last October on the day those killed were finally buried en masse. I counted dozens of coffins lined up on the ground, dozens of lives extinguished. 2 more people died close to the election. One death took place in the week before, after the opposition party called for protests related to alleged electoral irregularities. The other was on the day after the vote, when the opposition's headquarters in Freetown was surrounded by security forces who fired tear gas and potentially live ammunition, resulting in one woman's death. Fears around violence have also been inflamed by the prevalence of fake news or disinformation, which is shared through social media. Victor Jones, a journalist working for a UN-supported fact-checking effort called iVerify, said there was a quadrupling of fake news on election day, with it spreading particularly fast through WhatsApp. The negativity surrounding this particular election is alarming, he said. What I'm talking about is someone intentionally sharing fake news to disturb public peace. The election was Sierra Leone's fifth since its devastating 11-year war ended in 2002. An investment across the country was clear by the dedication of voters who queued for hours, despite delays and the threat of rain, to cast a ballot. But now the results are being disputed by the opposition, and the process has been criticised by observers and diplomats. In a press conference on Monday evening, the EU Observers Mission, which had deployed around 100 people, including at least two Irish observers, said there had been a lack of transparency and communication from Sierra Leone's Electoral Commission, which led to mistrust in the electoral process. It later noted statistical inconsistencies between the two batches of results provided and called for the release of more data. And later Ireland added its voice in a joint statement with the US, UK, France, Germany and the EU delegation. They all said they shared concerns about the lack of transparency in the tabulation process. Will that lead to anything? And what? We are waiting to see. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Sierra Leone.
Next to Ukraine, where the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam in early June killed dozens of people and forced thousands of others to flee. Ukraine has accused Russia of blowing up the dam, which was under Moscow's control, while the Kremlin insists that it was Kyiv that shelled the Soviet-era structure. Each side has blamed the other for the disaster. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has criticised what he says is the lack of an adequate international response to the disaster. Emmanuel Shaz has more from Kherson.
Back in November, I watched the liberation of Kherson from afar during a very brief and the only week of holidays I took from covering Russia's war against Ukraine. At the time, it felt like a huge glimmer of hope in an otherwise gloom situation. I felt like I was missing out on something really important in that war, but I was sure I would see Kherson one day. It happened this June, but there was no reason for celebration. After Russia's destruction of the Kakhovka Dam, huge parts of the region of Mykolaiv and Kherson were flooded, including parts of Kherson City. We're not talking about a few inches of water, but water reaching rooftops. Thousands of people were evacuated on the Ukrainian territory still under Ukrainian control. Thousands struggled alone, and it's still impossible to account for the victims living in occupied territories. Upon arriving in the region, I first noted the stark contrast between the picturesque sceneries. Green and yellow hills, ready for harvest. Ukraine remains a land of plenty, despite everything. But destruction and misery are never too far. And an hour's drive later, Russia's trail of destruction crashes the landscape. All along the road leading from Mykolaiv to Kherson, destroyed gas stations and bus stops, shelled houses and minefields remind that this region was only recently liberated, and at great cost. Once in Kherson, my first stop was to follow a group of volunteers gathering and dispatching donations, mostly drinking water and medicine, for the nearby villages worst affected. As they formed a human chain to carry all the water bottles from a basement to a delivery truck, Russia was shelling the city. While no one ever gets used to hearing the bombs, volunteers weren't fazed and would just look at each other with a "oh, that was close" look and grin before resuming their task. It's during the second stop in the city that I could measure the amount of destruction caused by the explosion of Kakhovka Dam. Here in a residential area, the water had already receded greatly when I arrived, but laid bare the damages caused by the water. It had reached the first floors of each building, and people who had not evacuated, mostly the elderly and their carers, were now attempting to save whatever they could with little success. A pungent smell of algae and hundreds of worms and seashells were to be found everywhere in the grey-brown street, now covered in mud. Firefighters, wearing head-to-toe waterproof gear, were here to pump out the remaining water from the basements. I thought this was bad enough, but the following day I visited the Snihorivka area in Mykolaiv Oblast, one of the worst affected zones, where villages along the Inulets River were cut off for days on end from the rest of the world as the river swelled exponentially. As a first-time visitor, I couldn't help but think at how the landscape was now similar to that of some Western Irish counties. Vast lakes, hilly, only the presence of water was far from natural here. And the green had given away to the muddy colour I had seen in Kherson before. As I crossed what used to be a communal football stadium by boat to reach the opposite shore, I only noticed the gold cage from its upper pole, visible only on few inches. In the village of Novovasilivka, I met farmers Yuri and Valentina, who in their 60s have lost everything. Their cozy house on the shore had become an inhospitable and ruined house in the river. Nothing was to be saved inside, only the walls remained. As for their animals, the 5 cows and the bees made it through, but not the chicken, which were freed on time, but eaten by starving stray dogs in the streets. Both Yuri and Valentina sustained light injuries on the legs from having spent days on end in the water, but they brushed it off when I asked about it. They said that they had survived occupation and now this flood. The couple insisted to share fresh milk and a cheese, all the products they would usually sell in the market of a neighboring village. But that, too, was no longer possible because of Russia's systematic destruction of Ukraine. When I asked them if they wouldn't prefer to evacuate, Yuri told me, to go where? We only have a couple of euros in our bank account, and there's our animals to care for. In Novovasilivka, the water has now receded. The recovery can start, but it will take years, if not decades, for the land to recover, for nature to blossom again, for many species to thrive again. And just like in countless other places in Ukraine, ordinary lives have been devastated. Beyond the incredible sorrow that people shared when I interviewed them, one thing struck me. They were all wondering why the world had had such a muted reaction to the destruction of Kakhovka Dam. People didn't just feel cut off from the world because of the high water, they also felt abandoned. Many asked me, why do we Ukrainians have to suffer so much? I don't have an answer to that. I can only bear witness. For World Report, Emmanuel Chaz from Mykolaiv and Kherson.
Finally, to Cameroon, where thirsty elephants caused panic after they trampled through a regional capital in search of water. Wildlife groups in Cameroon have been seeking to resolve the conflict between elephants and humans, which has led to protests in the past. From Cameroon, Dirkus Ekupe reports.
Residents of Mara, capital of far north Cameroon, woke up Wednesday, May 24, with panic and fear as they were surprised to see 4 stray elephants in the heart of the town. The 4 elephants left one of UNESCO's most important reserves in Central Africa, the Waza National Park, located in the far north region of Cameroon, and straight into the capital Mara in a neighborhood known as Kongola that hosts the Lone State University of the region. According to wildlife experts, the animals left their habitat in search of water, as the main reason for the shortage of the precious liquid is climate change. During the dry season in northern Cameroon, temperatures go up to 44 degrees, making the weather extremely hot and dry, not just for people living in the region, but also for animals. According to the director of the Waza National Park, Danboya Emmanuel, elephants in the park consume about 200 liters of water per day. He says that during the dry season, the elephants do not have enough water to drink. The Waza National Park in northern Cameroon is home to about 600 elephants. The population of these elephants keep increasing, but the park keeps degrading. The highest official in the Ministry of Forestry and Wildlife for the far north region of Cameroon, Jean Yeme, says the constant felling of trees also pushes these elephants to leave their habitat in search for a conducive climate. Though the animals were successfully guided back by forest guards to the park, one lady known as Bintu was killed by the elephant. One of her family members explains how it all happened. Her elder brother, Bulima, said she was amongst a crowd of curious and ignorant onlookers. Unfortunately, she went ahead to touch the elephant and tried to run away, but the elephant trampled on her and killed her. Conflict between humans and wildlife is common in northern Cameroon. On another occasion, heads of elephants strayed into human corridors in the Mayokani division of the Far North region in the locality of Gudum Gudum. Sadly, a girl of 6 years died. According to forestry and wildlife officials in Far North Cameroon, dozens of people have died due to attacks from elephants in the past 10 years. Muhammadu Bashiru is a conservationist in the region. He has an organization that has been fighting against human and wildlife conflict for the past 5 years. He advises the local population dig holes of 2 meters deep and that the local population should stop attacking elephants. He says if transhuman corridors of elephants are continually blocked by human activities, human and wildlife conflict will persist. A view that officials of Cameroon's Ministry of Forestry share, but add that the state is organizing resources to build artificial ponds that can supply water to elephants. The hope of the populace is that as they leave the migration corridors of elephants, these ponds will be constructed fast so that the elephants will stay in their own habitat. For World Report, I am Dorcas Ekope reporting from Mara, Cameroon.
That's it from World Report for today. The program was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you could go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Sharon Lynch, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.